Let's cultivate our motivation. Really think about what taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha means. That it means that we've thought about our life and the situation that we're in. We know what dukkha is. We understand that the chief causes come from our own mind as afflictions and karma. We know that it's possible to eliminate those so that a state of peace exists. And then we come to the fourth noble truth, where we want to follow the path to that state of peace. So our refuge is in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and this conviction in the four noble truths is part of our refuge in the Dharma. And then when we are able to actualize the last two truths, true cessations and true paths, then those become the actual Dharma refuge in our mind stream. So then, while right now we're taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha external to us, our purpose is to become the three objects of refuge ourselves by actualizing true cessations and true paths, becoming an Arya, and then perfecting that realization and becoming a Buddha. And the whole reason we're doing that is because we want to cease not only our own suffering, but the misery and dukkha of all living beings. And so we seek full enlightenment in order to be able to do that. So let's take refuge now and generate our motivation. And so now we're starting on the ultimate bodhicitta. Ultimate bodhicitta meaning the wisdom that directly realizes emptiness. Okay? And last week we talked something about the degrees of bodhicitta and so on. That question came up about that. And what it is that there's three places where bodhisattvas are said where they can attain a state of irreversibility. Okay? This doesn't just mean that they won't lose their bodhicitta, but that some special quality of their bodhicitta is not going to be reversible. And it seems that it, these different times when they can receive signs of irreversibility, that that's when they might be find themselves in the presence of a Buddha who makes a prophecy about the time they're going to get enlightened. You know, because in the Mahayana sutras, there's all these sutras where one Buddha will prophesize the time when a certain bodhisattva will get enlightened. So it's usually at one of these three times when they have a sign of irreversibility. So for very sharp faculty bodhisattvas, then they attain that sign as they enter into the path of preparation. And so at that time, in the first path, the path of accumulation, they have spontaneous bodhicitta that can still diminish and still until partway through the path of accumulation. But when they reach the second path, the path of preparation, at that time they have a unity of serenity and insight on the object of emptiness. And so that is a conceptual realization of Dharma, if these are new bodhisattvas who are entering the path, not ones who have become hearers and solitary realizer arhats before, but new bodhisattvas entering. And so at that time, you know, they have this strong realization of emptiness. It's still conceptual. It's inferential, but it's very powerful. And so that combined with the conventional bodhicitta, you know, in a bodhisattva of high faculties, that's going to be pretty significant, isn't it? Yeah, because when you really see the emptiness of sentient beings, then, you know, it's so much easier to cultivate compassion for them. Then you also understand that the cause of their dukkha can be eliminated, okay? And you have, you know, full faith in the possibility of attaining enlightenment. And so that's going to completely revolutionize your conventional bodhicitta, isn't it? Okay. Then the next place on the path where they can often have a stage of irreversibility, and this is for the medium level, medium faculty bodhisattvas, is when they have the path of seeing. And so at the path of seeing, which is the third bodhisattva path, that's when they have direct insight into emptiness. So they still have that unity of serenity and insight. And now it becomes a direct realization of emptiness, not an inferential one, like on the path of preparation. Okay? So then you can see again that when you have direct realization of emptiness, that's going to really change your conventional bodhicitta, isn't it? Yeah, because that's just going to make your faith in the possibility of enlightenment so much more intense, you know. And also you yourself are approaching enlightenment, so you can feel that. And you're entering into the practice of the ten bodhisattva bhumis at that point too. Okay, then for the dull faculty bodhisattvas, anybody signing up for that one? then they have the signs of irreversibility at the eighth bhumi, which is, you know, or the eighth ground, which is on the path of meditation. Path of meditation is the fourth path. Okay, when you're habituating yourself with the realization of emptiness. And when you attain the eighth ground in the middle of there, then you have eliminated all the afflictive obscurations. So you become comparable in terms of your realization of emptiness to an arhat. Okay, and so again, that's going to really change your conventional bodhicitta, isn't it? When you've eliminated all the afflictions and all the ignorance, wow, you know, how you perceive sentient beings is going to change, how you perceive enlightenment is going to change, everything's going to really change. That's for the low faculty. And then on the fifth path, that's the path of no more learning, that's when you attain Buddhahood, and that's when you become the three jewels, you know, fully and completely. Okay?
So you need a lot of faith if you have low faculty.
If you have dull faculties, you have to work a little bit harder. Yeah. Actually, how they define dull faculties and sharp faculties? Sharp faculty people are on the wisdom side, and they don't just take things because somebody said something, but they really want to understand it. And so they probe and they ask questions and they inquire and they push and they debate and everything like that until they really get it and it makes sense to them. Okay? And then the dull faculty people, or maybe modest faculty is more polite, are people who are more inclined to faith and devotion. And so instead of inquiring so much, you know, if their teacher says something or they read a quotation from a scripture, then they just believe it out of faith and devotion. Yeah? And so they progress in that way. And that's considered, you know, kind of more modest a comparison to the sharp faculty ones who really question and use their wisdom.
Okay.
So now we'll start here. Okay, so in training, in cultivating the awakening mind, there are three factors. Okay, so they're starting the outline here. The type of person to whom the instruction should be given, the time for imparting the instructions, and the actual instructions on cultivating the ultimate awakening mind. Okay, so those are the three major outlines. So now we're going to start on the first one of those, the type of person to whom the instructions should be given. Yeah, because it isn't that you just give instructions about emptiness to, you know, anybody who walks in the door. Yeah, that's not necessarily helpful for them or helpful for you. Okay, so our author says, first of all, these teachings should be given to someone who possesses the quality of a suitable recipient. To do so otherwise would be the cause of a transgression for both the teacher and the disciple. Okay? So there is one, the 11th of the root bodhisattva vows is not to teach emptiness to the unprepared. Okay? And the reason for this is, and we'll see it, it's coming up here in the text, is that if somebody's not prepared, then when they hear about emptiness, they'll think it's nothingness, yeah, and they'll fall to the extreme of nihilism. And nihilism, when you negate the ethical dimension of our actions and that the actions we do have effects, when you're negating the law of karma and its effects, that's extremely dangerous. Because then you say, well, it doesn't matter what I do, it's not going to have an effect, so I can do whatever I want. And then a person with that kind of wrong view does whatever they want, and in the process of doing that, then they create so much negative karma. So that's why, you know, when they talk about the 10 non-virtues, yeah, the last one of wrong views is said to actually be, in one way, the most serious. Because if you have that kind of wrong view, then you do the other 9. Okay? Because you think, it doesn't matter. I can do whatever I want. I mean, that's what I thought when I was young. I didn't know anything about past and future lives. And I thought, you know, as long as you don't get caught, because I didn't want to wind up in jail. As long as you don't get caught, do whatever you want, because it's not going to have any kind of lasting effect. I mean, maybe sometimes there was, you know, some sense of internal integrity of, you know, I'm not going to do that because that's not a good thing to do. But there was a certain period in my youth where I just kind of put that out the window and said, well, let's just try doing it another way and see how far I can push it. Yeah? Did you go through that? See, you know, let's see how far I can push it without getting caught, without getting into trouble. Yeah? And then you wind up doing a whole lot of negative karma. Okay? So this is the disadvantage of, you know, not thinking that our actions have an ethical dimension and bring results that we ourselves experience. Okay? Now, of course, some people have, you know, an innate sense of integrity, and they may not know anything about past and future lives, but they say, that doesn't fit in my ethical repertoire, I'm not going to do that, you know, it's just not good to do that. And, you know, they're thinking about the welfare of the other person or whatever, or maybe they have a theistic worldview and they're going to say that's going to displease God, or for whatever their reason, then they'll abandon the negative actions, and that's quite good. Yeah, but if you go to the extreme of thinking, oh, there's nothing, then you're really in big ethical trouble. Okay, so that's why there's this precept not to teach emptiness to, you know, Joe Blow who walks in off the street. Okay, if you wonder how you can tell who has the qualities of a suitable vessel, Chandrakirti's supplement to Nagarjuna's treatise on the middle way says, and these are verses that are quite often quoted, just from seeing smoke, you know there's fire. And from seeing waterfowls, you know there's a lake. So from observing the characteristics, you will know the lineage of one having the mind of a bodhisattva. Okay? So if there's smoke, you know there's fire. If there's waterfowl, you know there's a lake. So if there's certain characteristics, then you know it's somebody who is in the bodhisattva lineage, who is at a point where there's a suitable vessel to receive these teachings. Okay, so now I'm just going to go on and tell you what those signs are. Okay. Everybody all gets excited at this point. Okay, so you will be able to gauge suitably from external physical and verbal signs. But what would these signs be like if, when hearing instructions on emptiness for the first time, you feel a pleasure, joy, and rapture that gives rise to such physical symptoms as the bristling of your hair and tears welling up in your eyes? These are unmistakable signs. Okay? So when you go to hear teachings about emptiness, yeah, you have this feeling of bliss and rapture and joy that's so intense that the hairs on your body, you know, stand up straight and your eyes fill with tears and you're really moved. Okay? Now, most of us go to our first teaching on emptiness and go, what in the world is he talking about anyway? Or we go, this teaching is so long, I want to stretch my legs. Or, you know, we have some other reaction, okay? Now, I must also say, just because your hair stands on end and your eyes fill with tears, that doesn't necessarily mean you're a high bodhisattva. Okay? My hair stands on end when it's cold, and my eyes fill with tears when I hear sad stories. So, you know, we shouldn't get too excited here. Okay? No, I say this because I remember years ago, there was one person who, you know, there's also something about if you have these kind of signs, then it means you've met your root teacher. So that person, I remember, was Geshe Sona Rinchen, walked in to give a teaching, and she said, oh, my hair stood up, and I was so emotional, and he's my root guru, and I want to ordain. And it's like she knows nothing about the Dharma. And so I was trying to say, oh, Geshe-la is a wonderful teacher. Yes, you should definitely follow them. It will benefit you completely. But maybe wait a while until you ordain. She got quite upset with me. And then years later, she came to a retreat and she thanked me. Mm-hmm. You know what I said. But anyway, that's off the topic. Okay, so the supplement by Chandrakirti says, when an ordinary being, on hearing about emptiness, feels, so it's an ordinary being, somebody who hasn't realized emptiness, feels great joy arising repeatedly within him, and due to so much joy, tears moisten his eyes, and the hair on his body stands up, he has in his mind the seed of complete enlightenment, and is a fit vessel for intimate teachings on emptiness. Okay, so that's how Chandrakirti is talking about this person. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean that the rest of us aren't suitable vessels and shouldn't be taught emptiness, because as we'll go on to see here, you know, if we have some stability in the four preliminaries, then we can start to learn about emptiness. But one time, this was many years ago, must have been, I don't know, like 81, 82, Kempe Sung Rinpoche was in Dharamsala, and I went to ask him a question, and it was about emptiness. And Rinpoche, very, very kind of, you know, stern sometimes. His eyes were incredible. When you looked at them, you knew he had realization. There was like nobody there, okay? So I asked him my question about emptiness, and he looked at me and he said, I can't remember the exact words, but it was something to the effect of, you wouldn't understand the answer if I told you. like that. And I said, okay. And then he proceeded to, you know, give me a small talk about emptiness, even though he knew I wouldn't understand the answer to the question. This was quite remarkable. He was very frank. Okay. So, now we're going to get into why you don't teach emptiness to people who aren't suitable vessels. If emptiness is taught to unsuitable recipients, some fearful and without faith will turn away from it. And if they abandon it, they reject the essence of the transcendent doer's teachings. And due to their spurning the truth of that doctrine, they will wander endlessly through the realms of ongoing existence. Okay? So some people, yeah, they're fearful, they don't have much faith, yeah, they hear teachings about emptiness, and they go, that's wrong, you know, that's nothingness, that's ridiculous, I don't want to become nothing. You know, there's like a lot of fear that I'm just going to, if emptiness is true, it means nothingness, and I'm going to disappear into nothingness, and nothing exists, and this can't be right, this can't be true, this teaching is all baloney, and they push it away, okay? And so because that person hasn't been prepared enough by learning about karma, by learning about conventional truths, by, you know, learning that emptiness doesn't mean nothingness. You know, because they don't have that kind of preparation, when they hear about it, they jump to the wrong conclusion. They push it away, and in that way, they're abandoning the Dharma. They're rejecting the Buddha's teachings, you know. And they could get really frightened, really scared, and say, I'm out of here, and I'm never going to listen to any Buddhist teaching again. It doesn't make any sense. It's ridiculous. And then that mind state, rejecting the Dharma, you know, creates the cause for them not to meet the Buddhist teachings or not to understand the teachings, even if they do meet them. And thus they wander endlessly in samsara. Okay? Yeah? So that's one thing that happens. One kind of person. Yeah? Then another kind of person, yeah? Some who have superficial faith will mistake the meaning of emptiness and assume it means non-existence. Due to such distorted thinking, they will plummet over the precipice by ignoring the specific consequences of positive and negative actions. Okay? So this is somebody who has a very superficial faith, okay? And they hear these teachings on emptiness. And like the first person, they also think that emptiness means nothingness. But whereas the first person pushed it away and said, that's not true, this person is saying, oh yeah, there is nothingness. And so, therefore, you know, it's nothingness, and then they ignore the consequences of positive and negative actions. In other words, they reject the law of karma and its effects, what I was talking about before. Okay? So both people are rejecting, thinking in a distorted way that emptiness means nothingness, but they're reacting in two different ways. Okay? One is by rejecting that interpretation and saying the Buddhist teachings are wrong. The other one is, you know, accepting that in their wrong interpretation and then saying, therefore, I don't need to keep good ethical conduct because it's all nothing. Okay? So this is the big danger. However, if these teachings are given to those characterized, as explained above, as suitable recipients, due to their faultless understanding of emptiness as conveying the meaning of dependent arising, their realization of emptiness will become a totally pure path to liberation. So those previous people whose hair is standing on end and their eyes are filling, they clearly have had, you know, had some connection with the Dharma in previous lives. And because of that, when they hear this, you know, it makes the seeds in their minds start to ripen, You know, and those seeds were imprinted in previous lives when they studied and thought about meditation, about emptiness, and tried to understand it, and so on. And so even they haven't realized it in a previous life, they have great faith in it because they did do some study and reflection on it. Yeah, and so then they have those kinds of signs this life, and then they become the suitable recipients. Okay, so that those are the people who are the 100% A-OK suitable recipients. Yeah, it doesn't mean nobody else can hear teachings on emptiness, but they're the superb ones, okay? And as a result of that, you know, as they understand emptiness and as they reflect on it, as they meditate on it, okay, their realization will become a totally pure path to liberation. So they'll start out with an inferential realization of emptiness, and then when they have the direct perception of emptiness, a path of seeing, that becomes a true path, you know. And then those true paths lead to the true cessations, those being the cessations of different levels of afflictions as you go on the Bodhisattva bhumis, okay? So this is because they will maintain... Yeah, and here's why they're suitable, okay? This is because they will maintain all the aspects of the method side of the path, such as purely safeguarding their ethical conduct, which is what qualifies them as suitable recipients for taking the practice of hearing, contemplating, and meditating on emptiness to heart. Okay? So what they've done, this has qualified them as suitable recipients, is that they have really learned the method aspect of the path quite well. Yeah. And so that's why we start out so much, you know, talking precious human life and death and refuge and karma and the Four Noble Truths and bodhicitta and, you know, all these things to do with conventional existence. And you know, how different things work together, you know, what causes what's the result of what, you know, because so much of these earlier Lamrim meditations are talking about that, aren't they? When you study precious human life, you're learning, you know, what are the causes of precious human life, so, you know, you already know it exists and it's produced by causes and, you know, and then if you think about death and future rebirth, again, it exists, it's produced by causes. The objects of refuge exist, they're produced by causes, true cessation is permanent, we won't count that. But the other ones are, you know, when we study karma, and then as you're doing the bodhicitta meditations, you know, you can see how each of the lower meditations is not lower, but initial meditations, is a cause to understand, you know, the subsequent meditations. So that's the whole method side of the path. And as you study that and you start doing those meditations, you know, you get a better view of just conventional reality and how different causes and effects work. And, you know, you're taught that things exist. They may not exist in the way they appear to us, but they do exist. Okay, because they're produced by causes and conditions. Yeah. And so if you have that kind of basis, you know, then there's less chance of falling into nihilism when you hear teachings on emptiness, because you've already studied all this other stuff about cause and effect and conventional existence. Okay, so you're not going to fall into emptiness. Yeah. And also by practicing the method aspect of the path, you know, and being quite familiar with it, you've also done a lot of purification, you've accumulated a lot of merit, and so again there too, when you meditate on emptiness, because of purifying, because of a strong accumulation of merit, then the mind is more stable, the mind isn't as inclined to misinterpret things, to jump to wrong conclusions, to misunderstand the teachings. Okay. So that's why we do a lot of purification and creation of merit. Yeah. Because we may be very intelligent in a worldly way. You know, you can have an IQ of who knows what and all sorts of degrees. But if you haven't done purification and merit, and collected merit, when you hear teachings, sometimes you just don't get them. Yeah? Or you get them, but you jump to the wrong conclusion. Or you're not even interested in the teaching, so you don't go to listen to start with. Okay? So that's why, you know, why we do the 35 Buddhas, you know, you're doing them every evening and doing mandala offerings and offering service and bodhicitta meditation and all that kind of stuff. Because that makes the mind stronger and more stable. Okay? And you can feel that coming as you practice, can't you? Would you say your mind is more stable than it was a year ago? Yeah? No? I think so. So, I know most of you pretty well. Maybe there's one exception. Maybe two. They sleep through all the teachings. But even they're getting very good imprints about hearing the teachings. Yeah? Very good imprints. Okay. So, now there's another quote from the supplement. And Chandrakirti says, they will always adopt pure ethics and observe them. So these are people, you know, the people who are good recipients, suitable recipients. So they try as best they can to abandon the 10 non-virtues. And then they take precepts when they're able to, any of the various levels of precepts. They will give out of generosity. Okay, so again, because they have faith in cause and effect, and they know that generosity not only brings happiness to the other person, but it is a condition for having a precious human life, you know, and if they motivate it by bodhicitta, it can, you know, become something that leads to full enlightenment. So because of that kind of faith in cause and effect, then they're generous. Through generosity, they accumulate a lot of merit. Okay? So even, I mean, generosity is good no matter who you are. Yeah, I mean, we have all these reasons about, you know, you accumulate merit, and so you approach enlightenment, and da-da-da-da-da. But even on a totally unreligious level, people value generosity, don't they? And we look at people who are generous, and, you know, and we say, wow, how kind they are, and they're not completely, you know, enveloped in themselves. I noticed I had to laugh at myself today. Shamatha the squirrel. This is my squirrel who lives by the cabin. So I leave food out for her. And so she found my preta offering this afternoon, you know. And she's not much bigger than the preta offering. But she, you know, grabbed it and she's munching. And I found myself saying, now share it with your friends. You know, it's like, okay, Shamatha the squirrel, don't be, you know, my silly. And I had to laugh because I think of how when I get something good, I don't share it with my friends. And yet here I am telling the squirrel that that's what she should do. Okay, so generosity. Okay, that person will cultivate compassion. Yeah, so again, person practicing the method aspect of the path is definitely going to cultivate compassion. Yeah, and this doesn't matter whether you're on a here, solitary, realized, or bodhisattva path. You know, all of them meditate on the four immeasurables. So you cultivate compassion. You know, some people think, oh, the people who follow the here and solitary realizer path, they're all selfish, they have no compassion. It's not true, you know. They meditate on the four immeasurables just like we do. You know, and in many cases they have more compassion than us who just kind of say the four immeasurables and then, you know, take it all for ourselves. Okay, they will cultivate compassion and will meditate on fortitude. Okay, so again, yeah, keeping ethical conduct, generosity, fortitude, those are the first three far-reaching practices. Okay, show they're having patience, you know, patience or fortitude, again, because they know that if they cultivate that, then they won't harm so many people. It reduces the opportunities to get angry, and anger destroys our merit, and, you know, so they have confidence in that. They practice fortitude. Dedicating each virtue entirely to full awakening for the liberation of wandering beings. So when they create merit, then they dedicate it. Yeah. And they dedicate it to the full awakening for the liberation of all wandering beings, okay? So they're dedicating it for their own enlightenment so that as an enlightened being, they'll best be able to be of benefit to others. So this practice of dedicating merit like this is another practice of generosity, okay? Because you're being generous with your merit. You're not saying, you know, this is my merit and I just want to be born in some, you know, super deluxe sense pleasure heaven and, you know, that's all I want and it's all for me and like that. But they really want to share the results of their merit because they know that even as you share the results of your merit, then those results increase and they just kind of multiply. Okay? And so by doing all these things, then they pay respect to accomplished bodhisattvas. So these people who are suitable vessels, when they see accomplished bodhisattvas and they see the qualities of those bodhisattvas, then they can identify them as, you know, virtuous qualities that they want to cultivate themselves, and so they pay homage to those bodhisattvas. Okay, and again here we see that when we pay homage to others, it actually makes our own mind more receptive to generate the same kind of realizations that they have through that process of respect and appreciation, then we work harder to develop those qualities ourselves. Whereas when we're jealous of somebody else's good qualities, yeah, then that doesn't help us at all to generate those good qualities ourselves, does it? Yeah, because our mind state is a complete opposite mode. It's quite a negative mode when it's jealous. Okay, so that was the first outline, you know, who to teach the teachings to. Now the second one is the time for imparting the teachings. And so here the text says, when stability has been attained, impart the secret teaching. Okay, or another translation, having gained stability, receive the secret teachings. Yeah. So here the secret teaching means the teachings on emptiness. Yeah. And they're called secret in the sense that you have to have a certain preparation in order to really benefit them. They're not teachings that you teach on the street corner. Yeah, you'll see this, you know, when His Holiness goes in to give a public talk, he doesn't start out with, you know, everything's empty, folks. He you know, because people could really misunderstand that. What does he talk about? He always talks about love and compassion and forgiveness, doesn't he? Always. Because when you practice that, then you stabilize your mind, you create merit, you purify, you know, you have a better life right here and now even. Okay. So the way people of the great vehicle lineage generally venture into the spiritual path is that they initially stabilize their view of emptiness and subsequently engage in the aspects of practice concerning method. So here he's talking about the sharp faculty person who initially, you know, the way it's worded here, it sounds like they only do the wisdom side of the path and no method and then go and do method after they've realized emptiness. That's not correct, okay? Because you always have to do method and wisdom together, always, always, okay? But what it's meaning is that that person will emphasize the wisdom teachings more in their practice, and when they have some kind of realization of emptiness, then they'll go back and perfect their bodhicitta. So it doesn't mean they haven't done any meditation on bodhicitta before, they haven't listened to any teachings on the method side of the path. Doesn't mean that. You know, they certainly have. But in terms of what they're emphasizing and what they want to gain realization on first is they go towards the wisdom side. Okay? And so somebody can have an inferential realization of emptiness actually before they even enter the path of accumulation. Before you even enter the first bodhisattva path, you can have an inferential realization. You can't have a direct realization before entering the path, but you can have an inferential one. Okay? And that can be something very powerful, and some people, you know, might really work on that quite intently to get that. Yeah. Now, we might say, well, I understand the argument, you know, the person is empty of inherent existence because of being a dependent arising. Yeah, I know I'm a dependent arising. Yeah, so, yeah, I've realized emptiness. Well, you know, our understanding of, because in the syllogism, you know, the I is empty of inherent existence because of being a dependent arising. First, you have to realize what they call we haven't come up a good word with this. It's the presence. It's the presence of the reason in the subject. In other words, you have to understand that the I is dependent arising. So that's one thing to really say, you know. I say, oh yeah, I'm a dependent arising. But do we really understand what being a dependent arising means? Do we really have a sense of that? And then, even more so, then you have to see everything that's a dependent arising is also empty. Or to put it another way, if it's a dependent arising, it is empty. Yeah. And that also is quite difficult to realize. Yeah. Because of, you know, the different philosophical tenet schools, only the Prasangikas say that. They're the only ones that say, if something is a dependent arising, it's empty. All the other schools say, if it's a dependent arising, it exists inherently. Yeah, so here you can see, you know, the real uniqueness of the Prasangika view. Because this whole teaching, like I was saying at lunchtime, this teaching on dependent arising is like so vital in the Buddhist tradition. And yet only the Prasangikas will say because it's, you know, if it's empty, if it's dependent, it's empty. All the other schools say if it's dependent, it exists inherently. Why do they say that? Because for them, if it's a dependent arising, it means it exists. And if it exists, it exists inherently. Because they've confused existence and inherent existence and think they're the same thing. Yeah. And so they don't want to go to the, and they think that if things don't inherently exist, then they must be non-existent. And you can't say if it's a dependent arising, it's non-existent. So then you have to say it exists, which means it inherently exists for those tenet systems. Yeah. But whereas the Prasangikas say, if it's a dependent arising, it's empty of inherent existence. So completely the opposite. 180 degrees. Yeah. It's kind of amazing when you think about it. Yeah. But we don't really understand what it means. And so that's why we might say, oh yeah, I understand the eye is empty because it's been arising, but we don't really. Okay. But we're, you know, we're meditating on this thing that the eye is dependent arising. We're thinking about it. We're getting some kind of understanding. And then we have to think about if it's a dependent arising, then it must be empty of inherent existence. Okay, why? Because if it's dependent, it cannot be independent. They're mutually exclusive. And independent existence is synonymous with inherent existence. So if they're dependent arising, then they cannot be inherently existent. They cannot have their own essence, some objectifiable basis that you can locate and say, that's it. Okay? And so that's why, you know, you see in the different philosophical systems, when they talk about what goes from one life to the next, what is it that carries the karma, then they all postulate something that really is the person that carries the karma. So some of them will say, oh, it's the, you know, it's all five aggregates. Well, that's kind of weird because the body can't carry the karma. Some of them might say it's the mental consciousness that carries the karma. Oh, yeah, sure, maybe it does, you know. But they're saying the mental consciousness is the person. And then the Chitta Madras say, oh, but there's a whole other consciousness called the foundation consciousness, you know, the storehouse consciousness. And this is the consciousness. It's like, you know, you just put all your karmic seeds there, and that's the one that goes on to the next life. So they have, you know, here's something that's like, you know, really, you know, existing from its own side there, that's, you know, this treasury of karmic seeds. So, you know, they all postulate something that you can isolate, that you can find when you investigate and say, this is the person that goes from one life to the next. Because they, you know, everybody has to have a way of accounting how the karmic seeds go from one life to the next. Yeah, because if you can't do that, then your whole theory about karma goes bye-bye, doesn't it? Okay, so they all postulate something. So they're all holding some inherent existence. There is something findable you can identify as the person, you know, that will carry the karmic seeds to the next life. Whereas the Prasangika say, you don't need that. You know, you don't need some kind of metaphysical thing like the foundation consciousness. Then you don't need to say the mental consciousness, the continuum of the consciousness, or anything like that carries the seeds. Because everything's merely labeled. So there's a mere I. Yeah, and the mere I goes from one life to the next. And then you go, ah, the mere I. You see, prasangikas think there's a real person. Well, no. Okay, because if you ask what is the mere I, okay, that's the I that is merely designated in dependence upon whatever aggregates are there. Can you find that I? No. No, can't find it. That's why they call it the mere I. Okay, because mere is negating it existing by its own characteristics or existing from its own side. Yeah. So mere I carries the karma. But you can't find the mere I when you look for it. Okay. When you don't look for it, you can talk about it. When you look for it, you can't find what it is. Yeah. So that's why they say that we use, you know, analytical wisdom to investigate the ultimate nature, how things exist in a deep way. But when we talk about conventional existence, that's that you don't use ultimate nature to understand that, because that's just nominal existence on the level of language and symbols and, you know, and things like that. And you don't have to analyze. Yeah, somebody says, where's the cat? And you say, there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you don't go, what cat? I want to know, if you start saying, which cat? I want to see the truly existent thing. You know, who really is Manjushri? Yeah? I want to know that. Then you're getting into the level of ultimate analysis. And you're not going to find anything that is truly him. But when you don't analyze, and you say, there's Manjushri the kitty, and there's Arch the kitty. Okay? And it's the same with us. Yeah? There's Semke. But when you try and ask, who is Semke? What's the real Semke? Yeah. Will the real Semke stand up? Yeah? Now look at that feeling you're having right now. That's the one. Okay?
you have the TV show Truth
or Consciousness. Right.
Be in this generation.
Okay. So, where were we? Okay. Okay. So, the people, you know, some people go into the emptiness side of the path. They emphasize that. And then when they have, like, the inferential understanding of emptiness, then they'll go and they'll really work very hard on bodhicitta. And through understanding bodhicitta, then when they have that understanding spontaneously, then they enter the path of accumulation. Okay. But in thought training, we're doing it the opposite way. So here it says, however, according to this tradition, so the tradition of the seven-point thought mind training, you first deeply contemplate the four fundamental topics of the preliminary practices, and then in the actual practice, you become well acquainted with the awakening mind and its attributes, seeking the meaning of enlightenment in the interest of others. Okay? So in this tradition of mind training, first you deeply contemplate the four preliminaries, which are first one, second one, permanence, third one, effects, fourth one, miseries of cyclic existence. Okay, so precious human life, death and impermanence, karma and its results, and the miseries of cyclic existence. Okay, so you meditate a lot on those, and you really kind of integrate them in your mind. And if you do that, you can have some really strong experiences in your meditation. You know, don't think that because they're called preliminary, they're kind of baby things and they won't affect your mind. If you really meditate, you know, quite deeply on them, they can affect your mind quite a bit. Yeah, quite a bit. Yeah, and then after you have that kind of stability, then you become well acquainted with the awakening mind and its attributes, seeking the meaning of enlightenment in the interest of others. Okay, so with that as a foundation, those four, then you start doing all the bodhicitta meditations that we've been going through for the last, I don't know, year maybe, you know, between the bodhicitta meditations and then the precepts and the commitments of mind training and all those kinds of practices. So then you do that. Yeah. In this tradition, it is only after you have stabilized your acquaintance with the aspects of method, okay, so bodhicitta and the four preliminaries, that the secret teachings concerning the cultivation of the ultimate awakening mind is imparted. Okay. Now, I don't think that means that you don't hear any teachings on emptiness until you have stability and all those other things. I think that it means, you know, of course, as you develop some awareness and some feeling for the preliminaries and even for bodhicitta, which is quite an incredible practice. At the same time, you hear some teachings on emptiness, and that influences your understanding of the preliminaries and of the bodhicitta. But you're just not making that your exclusive practice of putting the emphasis there, listening to teachings only on emptiness. Okay, because definitely while you're practicing the method side of the path, if you hear teachings on bodhicitta, it will help you in your practice on the method side of the path. Okay, because, you know, it's hard to practice the path if you don't have a global view and know what's coming next. Yeah. Why? What did I say?
When you're practicing the method side of the path, you said you would hear, when you hear teachings on bodhicitta, that will inspire
you. Oh, no, when you hear teachings on emptiness, it will inspire your practice of bodhicitta and the preliminaries. Okay. Good. Okay, so we have a... Yes, that hand went up very quickly.
I have two questions. One of them, you said that if all schools except the Prasangika would say that if something doesn't if something exists, then it has to exist ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't the Chitta Mantras accept that there are some things that do exist but don't exist ultimately?
Mm. The Chitta Mantras, they, yeah, they, when they, well, they talk about things not existing by their own characteristics, but the only things that don't exist by their own characteristics are the imaginaries. In the three classifications of their phenomena, it's only the imaginaries, which are, there's two kinds of imaginaries. Things that are non-existent, like the rabbit's horn and a self of persons, and then things such as, you know, non-compound permanent space. Okay, so those things that the permanent phenomena that exist because they're conceptualized, yeah, then they don't exist by their own characteristics. But
so imaginary things exist in the Chitta Mantra. Some imaginary.
Sure, yeah, yeah, like permanent space exists. Okay, but it exists only by conception. Yeah, whereas everything else, you know, has some kind of inherent or ultimate nature.
And then my other question is the first section of this part being the 11th Bodhisattva vow and not teaching to people who aren't ready.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like that's kind of like lip service, considering that pretty much all teachings are given to pretty much anybody. I mean, like our teachings are being broadcasted over the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody
mm-hmm.
can go see that right now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like, what is that vow, and what does that mean if nobody follows it? And it's not just us,
yeah.
But it's like nobody.
Okay,
you
so
can get teachings anywhere.
Yeah, so if you can get teachings on emptiness anywhere, what is the meaning of that vow? Because it seems like nobody's following it. Well, I'm assuming that even though we're broadcasting this, that it's only people who've been following the series so far who are going to be listening in. You know, I can't imagine if there's anybody out here and it's your first night and you haven't heard any Buddhist teachings before, please email us and let us know. Okay? But I'm kind of assuming that there's nobody like that out there, that they're all people who've been following along for some time or who have done some reading or something like that. Okay.
Like, for example, books that are published.
Yeah.
Anybody can go pick up a book on emptiness without having any idea about it.
Right. Yeah, you can go and you can pick up Nagarjuna's thing, and, you know? Yeah, translation thing. But the idea is, that's like what Tsong Rinpoche said to me, you know? You wouldn't understand it even if I told you. It's like if you pick up Nagarjuna's fundamental wisdom and you haven't you know, done any study, you're not going to understand what in the world he's talking about. Yeah? So I don't think you're going to have the danger of falling into nihilism, because you won't even understand enough to fall into nihilism.
How about introduction to emptiness? Okay, anyway, that's just an argument.
Okay.
But I wanted to also make a comment that for people, an example for people who fall to the extreme of nihilism and negate cause and effect.
Uh-huh.
Bhikkhu Bodhi used the example of Charles Manson, which I thought was very good.
Mm.
And he said, I don't think he even really realized that Charles Manson was so well known, because
mm-hmm.
he was watching the actual trial when it happened, and then I think he went off to Sri Lanka or whatever.
mm-hmm.
But he said that Charles Manson was like in the courtroom or something, and he was saying something to the extent of, it's all a dream. It's all a dream.
Mm-hmm.
Man, it's all a dream.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Yeah. Okay, so you're saying an example of somebody who really went on the nihilistic extreme was Charles Manson, who was saying in his trial, it's all a dream. So this is, you know, how somebody can misunderstand things. Because we say in the tradition, things are like dreams. Yeah. Now, if you're listening to the teachings, the teacher will also say they are like dreams, but that doesn't mean they are dreams. It's when you think they are dreams, that's when you can go to the nihilistic extreme, like Manson did. Yeah.
I have a few questions, but one of them is that you just said a sharp faculty person emphasizes the wisdom teachings, but in this tradition we don't. So, so is this the tradition for the people of dual faculty? So you have to go down the whole floor. What are they saying when they say that?
Well, I've had the same question. No, I think they're saying, you know, that for some people, you know, they do the emptiness teachings first and then generate bodhicitta. But this is a mind training teaching. Yeah. So it could be they're saying it's for the more modest faculty people, or they could be saying, you know, it is called mind training. Yeah. And so you want to start training the mind at the very beginning with precious human life and death and impermanence and things like that. So you start training your mind in that way. And also because generating bodhicitta is so important, and some people, if they get too interested in renunciation and wisdom, then there's the danger that they don't generate bodhicitta and they enter into the hearer vehicle or a solitary realizer vehicle and become an arhat. Okay, so you want to make sure that you have a lot of teachings on bodhicitta, even if you emphasize the method side, so that you make sure that you'll enter into the bodhisattva vehicle.
And the second question I had too is this the 7-point cause and effect doesn't emphasize influence very much, because
right.
It exchange itself with others.
It does, right.
So that's also part of what we've just been studying.
Yes.
So again, they
did not say in the book this is the technique for dull people.
I'm looking for a home, I guess. Right?
No, they didn't. They didn't say that.
Yeah, but it doesn't make sense to me to say that this one does not teach that, because we just doesn't emphasize that.
Yeah, it doesn't emphasize it, because we did, you know, we did study equalizing, exchanging self and others. That does have the perspective of emptiness. But you see what I'm saying? I didn't say that if you meditate on the wisdom aspect, you don't do any bodhicitta. And if you meditate on bodhicitta, you don't do any wisdom.
Yeah.
I didn't say that.
I know you didn't say that. That's why this statement didn't make any sense to me. But I'll think about it.
What statement?
This thing about according to thought training tradition, we don't emphasize emptiness.
It says, however, according to this tradition, you first deeply contemplate the four fundamental topics of the preliminary practices, and then in the actual practice, you become well acquainted with the awakening mind and its attributes, seeking the meaning of enlightenment in the interest of others. In the tradition, it is only after you have stabilized your acquaintance with the aspects of method that the secret teachings concerning the cultivation of the ultimate awakening mind is imparted. And I explain that when it says only after, it doesn't mean that you have to enter the bodhisattva path before you get any teachings of emptiness. It just means that you have some stability in the method before you get the teachings on emptiness. It did not say here you don't teach people emptiness. Okay? Want to see? Yeah.
I have a question about the distinction between talking about emptiness with somebody versus teaching it. Because if somebody, you have a discussion with someone about what you learn, what you learn,
okay.
Is that kind of why I can't tell you? I'm not sure.
Okay, so a very good question. The difference between just talking about emptiness versus teaching it. And what happens if you're having tea with your friend and says, oh, you know, they say, well, what did you hear in the Dharma class last night? And then you go, oh, well, you know, it's a secret teaching and you haven't done the preliminary. So, sorry, I'm not going to tell you. No. you know, you can say to your friend, oh, you know, we were just talking about how things don't exist in the way that they appear to us, you know, to our consciousnesses. Or we were talking about how things exist dependently, you know. Because if you talk about dependent arising, you're implying, you know, emptiness. But you're talking about dependent arising, and so you're encouraging people, you know, everybody can understand something about dependent arising. Okay? Yeah? Yeah. So when it says this one about, you know, not teaching emptiness to the unprepared, it doesn't mean you don't teach dependent arising. Okay? Just because dependent arising is one of the reasons that proves emptiness, it doesn't mean you don't teach it. Yeah, because actually dependent arising, like I was saying, it's you know, the chief of the reasonings, because it establishes conventional existence and negates inherent existence. And, you know, if your friends ask you about emptiness, or if you're, you know, sometimes I'll be invited to go give a talk somewhere and they want me to talk about emptiness. You know, and I have no idea of the people in the audience, what level background they are, and it's maybe, you know, public talk, there's likely to be some new people there. So what I do is I talk about how we create things by conception, and then we think that they have some meaning in and of themselves. And then I give examples like when we talk about manners. You know, one culture will say this is good manners and this is bad manners. But in another culture, the complete opposite will be true. But when we grow up in a certain culture and we learn what good manners are in that culture, we solidify it and rigidify it. And then when we see somebody not behaving that way, we criticize them. But actually, it's just because of the way we labeled things that makes it bad manners. It's not inherently bad manners, because in another culture it's good manners. You know, like sticking your tongue out. Yeah, in our culture it's very bad manners to stick your tongue out. In Tibetan culture it's a sign of respect. Yeah? So it's a very good example of how you can say how things, you know, I'll use this kind of example of how things don't exist that way from their own side. They become like that due to our conceptual processes. And that's a good example that people can understand, you know, and they're not going to fall to nihilism thinking about that. It might actually make them more culturally tolerant. Okay? So, you know, that kind of thing. Or you talk about, you know, if you want to talk about how things are mentally labeled, you know, you just talk about, you know, there's Prince Charming and, you know, infallible and perfect. And, you know, I can't live without him. And everybody else kind of looks at the guy and goes, you know, whereas if he, you know, he had some inherent something inside, everybody would see that and react the same way. So, you know, people don't. So then you can see that there's not some inherent beauty. You know, it's due to our conceptual processes and our perspective. You know, so that's a good way to introduce people to the notions of emptiness without teaching emptiness. Gotta stop now.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and the spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losung's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Dvara, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow, May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Power of both ends and yet so generously, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West World.